Good afternoon, everyone. You know, this is outdoor service number 11, and I know I speak to you almost every time with the COVID announcements, but believe it or not, I haven't given a message yet in an outdoor service, so glad to have the opportunity now. I've given all the tips about blowing breezes and sun in your eyes to all the guest speakers and the regular speakers. Well, now I get to apply all that advice to myself. Well, today I want to address the COVID-19 pandemic. And of course you're going, oh no, I've heard enough about that. I've heard enough talk. I'd rather think about something else. That is understandable. It's been with us for almost 11 months, and there is pandemic fatigue. Fatigue in thinking about it and hearing about it and abiding by restrictions and precautions. Let me tell you, the title of this message is Some Lessons from the Pandemic. And there are so many lessons we can learn from this experience. Not all are strictly spiritual. And for us who live according to God's purpose, this lifetime as physical beings is a learning ground, a training ground, a testing ground. And so potential lessons exist in all areas of life. So in this message, I'm not going to spend much time on maybe the most important message of the lesson from the pandemic, but I am going to mention it because God's ministers have preached on it for 11 months, time after time, about spiritual wake-up calls and spiritual preparation and spiritual diligence that COVID-19 has impressed on us. So if I have not heeded, if you have not heeded, then it's our loss, and we will be held accountable. Let's go right to lesson one. Lesson one is health matters. I mean physical health matters. Now, if there are some terms that you've heard during COVID-19, comorbidities, underlying medical conditions, vulnerable populations have to be among them. Early on in the pandemic, it was clear that the ability for COVID-19 to bring severe illness and death was not equal opportunity. It was not spread equally across age groups or populations. Compare that to the Spanish flu of 1918. That killed 50 million people, 675,000 in the United States. The CDC website says mortality for the Spanish flu was high in people younger than 5 years old, 20 to 40 years old, and 65 years and above. The high mortality in healthy people, including those in the 20 to 40 year group, was a surprising feature of this pandemic. But you know about COVID-19. It's been borne out that those who are most susceptible are the elderly and those who have underlying conditions. Any number of conditions can increase the possibility of severe illness and death due to COVID. You know what they are: cancer, chronic kidney disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, immunocompromised state, perhaps from a solid organ transplant, obesity, serious heart conditions such as heart failure, coronary artery disease, sickle cell disease, type 2 diabetes. From the Journal of the American Journal of Managed Care, they published a study in November 2020 on the link between COVID-19 and comorbidities. In this study, they reported the percentage of persons who became infected with COVID-19, 52% had a comorbidity, 48% did not. But for those who died from COVID-19, 83% had a comorbidity and 17% did not. So the report said lack of comorbidities was partially protective against COVID-19, but not completely. And I'll just add that there's always the possibility that someone had an underlying condition that was undiagnosed or unrecognized. This discussion is not to make anyone feel bad for poor health decisions in the past or hereditary conditions or the degree of randomness that gets intertwined in our health at any given time. And of course, as we age, bodily processes and organs get closer to the point of potential failure. But with that said, COVID-19 illustrates that health matters. Physical health matters in resisting the infection, in possibly moderating the effects, if infected, and overcoming, despite whatever level of treatment. And good physical health plays a major role in good mental health, overall quality of life. Good health can enable us to do more for the work of God and to contribute more to our families, the church, and the community as a whole. Perhaps in times past, the Church of God taught more about health. The church had booklets and articles on the biblical principles of health. The United Church of God covers the basic principles of health in our booklet titled Making Life Work. And the Bible has much to say about health. You shouldn't look at the Bible necessarily as some kind of detailed health manual or nutritional guide, but there is much wisdom from the Creator in the Bible about meats not to eat, fats not to eat, blood is not to be consumed, hygiene and sanitation practices, such as what to do with human waste, proper handling of mildew, quarantining for those who are contagious, the mention of the benefit of bodily exercise, the blessing and the need for good sleep, prevention of venereal disease, moderation in the consumption of food and alcohol, self-control, the avoiding of gluttony and excess. You know the old saying, and it's true, too much of a good thing is not good. But God obviously wanted us to discern and to learn more about what leads to vibrant health and observe what leads to poor health and what can be good to help the body heal and recover. And of course, the Bible proclaims that God can heal in any number of ways, and we can go to him as prescribed in James chapter 5, going to the elders, being anointed with oil along with the prayer of faith. And as many of you have seen, that healing can come quick and dramatic. It can come slowly over time, and sometimes it comes through advice from a person or a source that was truly a godsend. The general principles of health are well known, especially more than ever because of all the scientific information we have, and they're summarized in our booklet, A Healthy Balanced Diet, based on foods in a natural unprocessed state. Fresh vegetables, fruits, whole grains, unprocessed meat, poultry, and fish. Of course, there's proper hygiene and sanitation. Sufficient exercise. Most of our lives are very sedentary. We got plenty of labor-saving devices, so we need to counteract that with exercise that invigorates the body. There is an old saying, and it applies in all facets of life, or many facets of life, but it certainly applies to exercise and health. Use it or lose it. So we need to have sufficient physical activity and exercise so that we can maintain strength, functionality, dexterity, balance. Sufficient sleep and rest is required. And of course, we enjoy the rest of the Sabbath day, but rest also includes restorative recreation and activities that leave stress so that we're not wound up super tight, ready to explode. And of course, the prevention of major injury is very important. Now, if one never has a cut, a scrape, a bump, or a bruise, it may show that we're not doing very much. But on the other hand, we want to prevent major injury, which is often due to carelessness, stupidity, negligence, and that may lead to disability or death. So lesson one from the pandemic was physical health matters. What's lesson number two? Mental health matters. Mental emotional health suffered in this COVID era. There was an anxiety that started right at the beginning of the pandemic because you just didn't know how bad it would be. And then the lockdowns came. And that impacted businesses, jobs, and schools. So normal routines were shattered. One's normal social outlets were shattered. People found themselves isolated, lonely, even if they lived with other people. And I'm sure you know that for those who live in households, just having all family members together with each other in the same dwelling all morning, noon, and night is not a cup of tea. Some parents mention that the first week with kids in the house taking online lessons instead of being at school, along with the parents working from home, was complete pandemonium. For God's people, it required prayer and the power of the Spirit to stay sane. From the World Health Organization, they said, quote, bereavement, isolation, loss of income, and fear are triggering mental health conditions or exacerbating existing ones. Many people may be facing increased levels of alcohol and drug use, insomnia, and anxiety. COVID-19 can lead to neurological and mental complications, such as delirium, agitation, and stroke. People with pre-existing mental, neurological, or substance use disorders are also more vulnerable to COVID infection. Here's an interesting survey. The CDC surveys persons and asks if they have considered suicide in the last 30 days. In 2018, the percentage of all ages saying yes to the question was 4.3%. But in August 2020, it was 11%. For young adults 18 to 24, it was 10.7% in 2018. And in August 2020, it was 25.5%. So can you imagine that? A quarter of young people said they seriously committed, were thinking of committing suicide in the last 30 days in August of 2020. And many have been depressed over the past year. And sometimes when you would ask how they were, they would say, okay. Sometimes they weren't admitting to their depression. And other times they were not noticing their own deterioration. So God's instruction book has much to say about mental health. And the Bible does talk about the mind-body connection. We know that a positive mental attitude does much to promote physical health. And conversely, being immersed in negative, pessimistic thoughts will run us down. Proverbs has a number of precepts to talk about the mind-body connection. Let me just read a few. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. That was Proverbs 12:25. A tranquil mind gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. 14:30. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted ox and hatred with it. 15:17. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and good news refreshes the bones. That was Proverbs 15:50. And a cheerful heart is good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. 17:22. Let me turn to Philippians 4, verse 8. You don't need to turn there. It is a familiar verse, but Philippians 4, verse 8 says, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on those things. So is the Bible solution to good mental health a Pollyannish attitude? No, not quite. A Christian needs to be real and discerning and needs to tackle his own problems head on. But for the Christian, good mental health starts with a relationship with God, where we recognize His care, His love, His grace, and in gratitude, we make progress in walking His way and following His law. It's about believing, understanding, and then doing. There are many other practical aids to good mental health. I'm going to quote from Dr. Itai Danovich of Cedars-Sinai. Make sure you're not spending too much time on screens, that you're not getting overloaded with information you can't do anything about, but that you're getting information from reliable sources. So yes, it is easy to drown in the news. It's good to be informed and educated, but realize those news outlets are trying to keep your eyeballs and ears glued, so watch out. The doctor says in order to maintain good mental health over the long term, people should find ways to connect with loved ones and find ways to be of service. So I'll comment, wow, this doctor realizes the value of getting one's mind off self by serving others. He says, quote, having a sense of purpose is enormous. It allows people to cope with a lot of adversity. And I'll comment that God's people should know God's incredible purpose. But that purpose is so big and so broad, sometimes it's not actionable on its own. So you got to break it down to smaller goals and tasks in daily life that can be basic. Prayer, meditation and study, finding productive activity, learning something new, actually succeeding in achieving goals, enjoying social outlets, and practicing mutual love and consideration. He says, quote, but if you're finding yourself having persistent anxiety or feeling so down that you're not able to function, three important words, ask for help. We need to be humble enough to ask for help when we need it. And then he adds, there can be positive effects of the pandemic. It has created space in many people's lives to slow down and spend more time with their families and reflect on what's important and connect with one another in new ways. He said there can also be growth from the trauma of the pandemic. People can develop resilience. They learn to deal with health, with mental health challenges because they find resources and they that are internal, that are external, that they didn't know existed. So this doctor is talking secularly, but a follower of God can see the wisdom in what he is saying and apply it even more meaningfully. And we do have a responsibility, for example, to try to do what Paul did or talked about in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 5. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 5, where he said, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So we have to apply effort to think helpful, productive thoughts. And if a thought comes into our minds that is not fitting for a Christian or is going to drag us down, it needs to be discarded. Point number two, lesson number two, was mental health matters. Lesson three, the importance of the emergency fund. Now, perhaps the church taught more about finances in times past than we do now. But UCG has a booklet titled Managing Your Finances. And one of the chapters is Keys to Successful Financial Management. The church has taught about getting all facets of life managed properly. It's not just about the spiritual. We should be aiming to be as sound as possible, physically, mentally, emotionally, and financially. One scripture they cited was Proverbs 27, 23 to 27. You don't need to turn there, but let me read that. Proverbs 27, verse 23 says, be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds, for riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself, and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in, the lambs will provide for your clothing and the goats the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household, and the nourishment of your maidservants. So from a financial standpoint, the principle is know the state of your flocks. Know where you're at. Don't be blind to where your money is being spent, and don't be neglectful of the source of your income and your livelihood and your ability to be generous to others. Proverbs 22, verse 3 says, a prudent person foresees the danger ahead and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 8. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. So we have wisdom from God about storing up in a time of plenty for a future time when things are scarce. And our booklet mentions ideally that one has a 3 to 6 month emergency fund. And so does virtually every Christian-oriented financial advisor like a Dave Ramsey and any number of secular sources. And why is this so wise from a biblical perspective? Well, it's a cushion of time that gives one time to react upon loss of job or upheaval or catastrophe. So with that cushion, one has time to adjust. One has time to look for new work or to plan a career change or a geographical move. You don't have to just move out and start trying to sell things to keep afloat. And the emergency fund is handy when, let's say, you suffer uninsured theft or there's a major auto repair needed. You've prepared for it through an emergency fund. You can look at the emergency fund as an act of love towards your household. And so with the millions of people who've lost jobs and work during the pandemic, one of the lessons that was affirmed was to have that emergency fund. And the Vanguard website says your emergency fund should have these costs included, the essential ones: housing, food, health care, utilities, transportation, personal expenses, and debt. You don't include expenses that you would normally cut from your budget in the event of major job loss or a catastrophe. So you're not including entertainment, dining out, non-essential shopping, vacations, saving for college. So lesson three from the pandemic was a reminder to have that cushion, that important emergency fund of 3 to 6 months of expenses. Lesson four, the pandemic provided an opportunity to evaluate one's attitude on giving, serving, and helping others. So life is unfair, and as people say, get used to it. There were some, as I mentioned, who lost work and businesses. And then there were others who didn't miss a paycheck and even had reduced expenses because they didn't have to commute to work. So those of us who did not miss income or a paycheck in 2020 should be thankful and grateful. And we should also have a heart of compassion for those who did lose work, income, businesses, whether in the church or outside. When Jesus was on the earth, of course, he showed compassion to people all around. So you've seen the lines that have formed at pickup points at some of the local food banks, whether it was a line of cars or a line of people. Many were people who had never had access to, had never had to access a food bank before. But for those who were doing fine, it was an opportunity to give or increase their giving to the local food banks or organizations that help the needy. And those who honestly needed the help to get through this tough interval should have accessed those resources without reservation or guilt while being grateful. The Bible teaches that we must be willing to give and also to receive humbly and gratefully as well. So for those of us who did not lose work or income, did we look at our giving this past year? And I am talking about beyond tithes and holy day offerings. Were our hands open and compassionate, or could we have done better? And in some cases, the way to give was to actually spend our money at a certain local business in our community, perhaps a restaurant or a shop that we know needs the support and supplies a product or service that we need, and they are selling it at a fair price. Perhaps one can hire someone he knows who needs the money for a small job that truly needs doing. That's actually another way of giving. So how did you and I do in the giving of our time and our abilities during this pandemic? How did we do in reaching out to family members, church members, and friends? Yes, precautions were needed in all sorts of situations, but the opportunities to help out were still there. And a few of our members set an excellent example of helping out at food banks, sometimes multiple times per week. And some members have been busy over the last few months, calling and visiting, checking up on people. So in our evaluation of ourselves, we see that we can ask ourselves, could we have done more? And if we think we could have done more, or should have done more, we can resolve to do better with God's help, starting now, as preparation for challenging times ahead. Lesson four was to evaluate one's own attitude of giving, serving, and helping others. Lesson five, recognize the necessity of human interaction and contact. The lockdowns and the stay-at-home orders have reaffirmed a truism in interpersonal relationships. So therefore, we need to talk about, and notice the wording, unsociable distancing. That's the title of an article in the November-December issue of Touchstone Magazine by Paul Mataliano. And I'm going to read much from it because he says it better than I could. The title of the article is Unsociable Distancing. He starts off by quoting a journalist named Jonathan Jones, who wrote in 2018, "From the time we are in the womb through our elderly years, touch plays a primary role in our development and physical and mental well-being. New studies on touch continue to show the importance of physical contact in early development, communication, personal relationships, and fighting disease. Although the therapeutic benefits have been increasingly clear, thanks to no-touch policies in schools and the isolating effects of cell phones and computers, Americans are touching each other less." Then Paul Mataliano says, "That was before COVID. So now we're in the age of Zoom meetings, virtual classrooms, working from home, and other interactions with no human contact required. The situation is far worse. While we humans have a wonderful ability to adapt, we run the risk of going from adapting to adopting. And if we permanently adopt a social distancing stance, we will lose part of what makes us human and move farther away from what God has intended for us as part of the created order. Indeed, we've been on that road for some time and it has led us to some dark places." So continuing with the article, he quotes from T. David Gordon, who wrote, "Recognizing the physical presence of another is to join God, who made us as material beings, in seeing that it was very good to have done so." In other words, those acts of courtesy by which we acknowledge the physical presence of another human are also acts of piety, whereby we acknowledge God's wisdom in making us this way. I'm going to read more from the article. "A lot happens to us when we are without physical contact with others for long periods of time, not least that we develop a tendency to devalue others. We start thinking we can operate just fine with no one actually in our proximity. Nowadays, we can be virtually present to others instead." And that's just like being there, right? Of course, he answers wrong, and he tells how the difference between a Skype call with his grandchildren and actually playing with his grandchildren. He also talks about how he made the decision during COVID-19 to go to a funeral of his nephew, and it was clear to him that that was the right decision. Closing the article, he says, "The apostles believed an essential aspect of their witness stemmed from the fact that they had been physically with Jesus." And then he quotes 1 John 1:1. Where it says, "What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life." So he says they had heard him speak to crowds. They had seen him face to face. They had studied him. They had touched him. And then he notes that the Greek word for looked connotes looking attentively or even learning by looking. And he says, "While we can see people via electronic means, we cannot really look at them or connect with them or have the same attentiveness towards them as we can when we are present with them." And he closes with one almost humorous and also balancing comment. It says, Ecclesiastes 3:5. And there it says, there's a time to embrace and there's a time not to embrace. So he says, "God is also a good epidemiologist. But that's not the norm. It is vitally important that he says it's not the norm that we shun embracing, that's what he means. It is vitally important that while we adapt to our current situation, we do not adopt the way of no human contact required. You recall Matthew 22:37-39. That's the two great commandments. Love God, love our fellow neighbor. So God intends that our lives are defined by our relationship with God and with fellow man. And being unsociably distant is unhelpful to both, because God intended and assumed physical presence, interaction, and contact. The importance of human interaction is one reason I decided to continue to have Sabbath dinners in my home for most of 2020, starting in late May, despite lockdowns and stay-at-home orders. Yes, if you were a dinner guest of mine, I did apply certain precautions, because when you're in my home, I'm responsible for you. And early on, I asked people not to contribute food or drink. All of it was going to come from my kitchen, from one source. I've asked guests to wash their hands upon coming in. I started with four persons. Eventually, it went up to six. I choose to keep it intimate and small. I put an extra leaf into my dining room table just to space things out a little bit. I tried to keep air circulating with fans and open windows. We ate outside on the patio when it was conducive. I discouraged the shaking of hands in my home as a precaution. Again, these are my approaches. They don't have to be yours. But I made the judgment that physical presence, physical sharing, Christian fellowship was too important to not accomplish that through the vehicle of the Sabbath dinner. And I also realized that many of my guests were battling, or let's put it this way, my dinners were battling loneliness, isolation, and depression among my guests. Plus, we had some new attendees to our congregation in 2020 who started attending and then experienced the shutdown of in-person services at various times. So I saw a need to get them connected with flesh and blood brethren, and Sabbath dinners were the vehicle for that. So some of this discussion leads to the question of a Zoom service for a live or a live service. The first question: is a telephonic or webcast service a valid Sabbath church service under circumstances? And the answer simply is yes. That has been the consensus of the church in the past and now. Going back decades, various shut-ins due to health and mobility may have accessed a service by a telephone hookup when it was available, and of course it was not widely available. And then in most cases prior to the wide availability of the internet, when someone could not attend a church service, they would study on their own or they would have recordings of sermons. But today, some of our brethren are in remote areas, hundreds of miles from a congregation. Some are sick or contagious, cannot travel, cannot attend. And they can access a church service through a webcast. I will note, I have no brethren, and you probably know them too, who do dress up a little for an in-home webcast. Not the way that they do to, that they would at services, but they understand that that webcast service is a convocation on the Sabbath. So the next question to ask is, are there big differences between the Zoom service and the in-person service? And as discussed in this lesson, it should be clear, yes. Assembling in person more fully acknowledges the essential nature of how God created man. Our personhood is body and mind, and God has given us faculties and senses to experience the presence and contact with other human beings. And the holy convocation, as mentioned in Exodus, or the church assembly, is intended to be a collective, interactive experience of worshiping together, praising God together, praying together, reading scripture together, learning together while hearing the same message. And per Hebrews 10:24-25, Hebrews 10:24-25, we're not to neglect the assembling of ourselves together. For what reasons? So that we consider one another, stir up love and good work in one another, and exhort and disciple one another. And that's all accomplished more fully in person. Next question. For those who can access an in-person Sabbath service, how long can the situation continue to attend via Zoom when the in-person service is available? Here, the answer is everyone has to make their own decision. It doesn't necessarily mean that every decision that is made is right, but personal circumstances vary, and those circumstances get involved in decision, and justifiably so. And assuming that no one starts off with a rebellious or disobedient or neglectful attitude, the right decision can depend on one's circumstances. Circumstances that one on the outside cannot see. And thus, we have counseled all of us to not judge our brother in decisions of attending the live in-person service or staying away from it and going to Zoom. And if there's one thing I've learned from COVID-19, sometimes when you eventually know all the reasons why people make the decisions that they make, sometimes it becomes very clear and sensible. So it's easy to judge from the surface, and we should refrain. So lesson 5 was to recognize the necessity of human interaction and contact. Lesson 6, making wise decisions in challenging circumstances is an exercise in godly leadership. And during this time, we've seen all kinds of leaders make judgments. And I'm not only talking about political leaders. Leaders of all sorts. We've seen good judgments and bad judgments. We've seen corrective actions. We've seen people change nothing and pass the blame. It's all over the map. A crisis like a pandemic will set up situations where leadership and wisdom is required, especially when there are multiple competing objectives that are all right and desirable, but they're in tension with one another. For the Christian, the desirable objectives are defined by the Bible. So here are just some of the good objectives and values that were in consideration during the pandemic. Protecting innocent life. Life is a gift from God. And it's sad if a life is unnecessarily shortened. Even if one had comorbidities that could have taken one's life, it's sad for a family when COVID-19 ended a loved one's life 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years earlier than some other disease would have knocked them out. Another important value, respecting mother and father and the elderly in general. You know the Bible commands, honor your father and your mother and to rise before the hoary head. So given that the elderly were especially susceptible during COVID-19, Christian understanding demanded that the elderly be considered. One well-known writer in Jerusalem argued for severe shutdowns on the basis of the biblical command to respect the elderly. Another value, loving your neighbor as yourself. We've talked about that. Another value, objective, maintaining access to our healthcare system, emergency rooms and ICUs. Another value, maintaining overall mental, emotional, spiritual health of society. Another objective, maintaining economic activity and the ability to work. John 5:17, Jesus said, "My Father has been working until now, and I've been working." The point is, God works, and He intended us to work. And that's how families are raised, and that's how bills are paid. Another objective would be to maintain the liberty to gather for purposes that we would consider essential, such as in-person religious services. Another value would be the freedom necessary to do the work of God. So those are all values, and they can be in tension with each other to some degree. So I'd like to point out an excellent example of leadership in this crisis It is not from the church. It is from Purdue University, one of my alma maters. Its campus, its main campus, is in West Lafayette, Indiana, and the president of Purdue for the last several years has been Mitch Daniels, who was at one time the governor of Indiana. They made a decision early last year in April that they would try to open up their campus for on-campus classes in August. And they did. Now, some may disagree with Mr. Daniels in Purdue. I personally think the facts show that they made the right decision in reopening in-person classes. But my purpose of bringing up this case is to illustrate a process of making decisions when there's multiple good objectives, but they are at tension with one another. And we can maybe apply this in areas of our life. So I'm going to read from an open letter from Mitch Daniels that was sent to alumni. This would have been a very short letter had we decided, as so many schools, not to reopen Purdue on schedule in August. We came to that decision only after careful, deliberate, collaborative, empirically based processes. Still, the choice was far from obvious. The most crucial scientific fact was the non-lethality, or let's say non-lethalness, about as close to zero as any phenomenon in this life, among the youthful population that overwhelmingly makes up the Purdue community. He's basically saying COVID-19 is not lethal to the college age crowd. And he says, if that's true, the implication was we could build a whole new way to operate the university that separated and otherwise protected potentially vulnerable members of the campus community. We could have the fall semester that the students overwhelmingly wanted. And he does bring up some facts that, for example, for an American age 65 to 74, it's four times more likely to die from COVID than an accident, three times more likely to die from COVID than diabetes. But compare that to stats for Americans 15 to 24. It's 21 times more likely to die in an accident than COVID, 11 times more likely to die by suicide than COVID, 8 times more likely to die by homicide than COVID. So these are the facts that they were looking at. At the end of classes, in fact, at Thanksgiving, we had identified 2,770 total student cases at Purdue. Not a small number, but he said less than 1% ever went past the fourth level of a six-level severity index, and more than 80% were completely without symptoms and had no more than one mild symptom, such as headache or temporary loss of taste. Among the staff, the 200-plus cases were only slightly more severe. During the entire semester, we only saw 7 hospitalizations, most very short-term and non-life-threatening. The 1,000 beds we assembled to isolate and to quarantine were never more than 26% occupied. But we knew none of this at the time when we had to decide. And here are some important life lessons. It's a rule of life that sound decisions to be made before it's too late must be reached with much less than 100% of the information we would like to have. And back in April, we were painfully short of 100%. And he said, viewed in April, both the longer-term epidemiological evidence and our ability to put together a system to manage the virus were far from certain. And he mentions that he approached this very prayerfully. He is a man of Christian conviction. So continuing on with the letter, this is not the place for lengthy dissertation on public decision-making, but it must be noted that Purdue was one of thousands of public entities responding to the pandemic. A fair definition of one's duty in any position of broad responsibility is the requirement to balance multiple competing interests, whether responsible for a business, a city, or an entire nation. The physical safety of those one serves is almost always the first duty and priority. But note this, But at any significant scale of endeavor, a first priority is never the only priority. And I'll observe that during this time, there have been attempts to focus on one parameter, one stat. And when you focus on just one stat and one parameter, it usually ends up being a very bad decision. History will judge, and may judge harshly, many of the choices various leaders made during 2020. It's undeniable that fearsome prices have been made for actions taken to address everyone's first priority, the health of the public. And he talks about the increase in opioid deaths and increase in suicides and deaths due to not getting medical screenings that you need and things like that. He also said the economic wreckage to countless lives will, in many cases, be irrecoverable, and the harm to young people from interrupted education also looks to be tragic. Scholars are already assessing the learning loss to younger school children. A researcher from Stanford found that Indiana grade students had already lost two-thirds of a year of progress in reading and more than a year in math. Like the economic stoppages imposed by the most extreme lockdowns, the effects will be far more pronounced on low-income families and children. So, of course, that adds to inequality. I'm going to go to the end of the letter, which mentions an important point. He thinks the number one factor of success was the student body. He said the single most important factor in direct refutation of a host of cynics, our students not only complied with the dreary restrictions of the Purdue Pledge, they led the campus in doing so. I'm asked daily how Purdue managed to struggle our way through an on-campus fall, and my answer is threefold. An early decision that gave us time to prepare, a commitment to do everything that might contribute to safety, and number three, magnificent student compliance, whether it was masking, maintaining distance, reporting for required testing, or just maintaining humor and calmness. I have a thick file, he says, of disparaging comments from pundits and others dismissing the idea of reopening schools because today's young people would never adapt their behavior to the necessity of the moment. He says one professor from another school sneered that reopening was delusional and predicted that students would be cavalier about wearing masks, ignore social distancing guidelines, begin partying in the hallways, get drunk, hang out and hook up with people they don't know well. But he says, I felt I had an advantage over these cynics. I had spent years getting to know the Purdue students, and those others had not. And then he said, we do have a small quotient of knuckleheads here, but overwhelmingly, I know our students to be deeply interested in doing something good for others. Protecting Purdue from COVID-19 meant protecting others. And as I expected, they rallied to the opportunity. Summary, wise heads got together, sought the facts and counsel, kept the overall mission of the university in mind. They prioritized safety, but did not make that the only priority. And they demanded and expected a high degree of personal responsibility and care for one another within the student body. And they made the decision to open. So in our Christian lives, we may have to make decisions where multiple goals or multiple biblical values are in tension in a given situation. With God's help and His Spirit, we can view the whole situation soundly and make the wise decision. So that was lesson number six. Finally, I wanted to conclude with very quickly about what we've heard over the last year. I mentioned it at the beginning as probably the key lesson from the pandemic, only because I've heard it preached so many times over the last year. And If we haven't heard this, then we weren't awake. Peter said on how to respond to tumultuous times ahead, it's 2 Peter 3:11, "Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness?" The context is prophecy, and understanding of prophecy should drive us to live that holy and godly life. Again, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? And so we know judgment eventually comes, and we should prepare to meet the next moment of trial and tribulation with faith and courage. So, the most often said message about being derived from the pandemic is it reminds us and motivates us to be spiritually ready and to prepare. So I've covered 7 lessons from the pandemic, certainly not the only lessons, but it gives us a nice broad perspective of lessons involving all aspects of our lives as we continue to walk the way of God and to serve and please Him.